Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have with us a man who has uncommon understanding of the magnitude of the challenges we face to this country from enemies foreign and domestic. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is one of our favorite guests and a regular here at Securing America, member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and the co-author with yet another of our much admired colleagues, Captain James Fennell, of a very important new book entitled Embracing Communist China, America's Greatest Strategic Failure. Brad Thayer is a man we turn to with regularity to talk about China. But we're also going to talk with him about Taiwan and the recent deployment there, apparently, of American military personnel, Army Special Forces elements. Brad, it's great to have you with us to visit about that, among many other things. Thank you for taking some time to be with us.
Frank, it's my pleasure to join you today.
Thank you. So what do you make of this, Brad? Good thing? Fraught? Necessary? Positive?
Well, absolutely necessary to do that. It's deterrence requires, of course, not only military capabilities, which is a key component. You have to have the ability to either threaten punishment or to convey to your enemy that he would be denied in his military objectives, what's called deterrence by denial, if he were to aggress. But it also requires willpower and commitment, credibility. All of that is served by having American military forces on the ground when we conduct an extended deterrent, for example, to Japan or West Germany, Frank, and our other NATO allies during the Cold War, as we've done around the world. Having American conventional forces backed by tactical nuclear weapons capabilities, theater capabilities, and ultimately the U.S. strategic deterrent is necessary to have seamless deterrence so that there's no level where an enemy could dominate if he were to escalate. So the reports that have come out with respect to a small number of U.S. Military forces and Kinmen, very close, as Frank, as you've observed many times, to the PRC, is a welcome development for augmenting deterrence. And it reminds us, of course, that the U.S. Navy supported what was called then called Quemoy during the Cold War, ensured the Seventh Fleet, ensuring that Republic of China forces based on Quemoy and Matsu in the language of the time were supported against the aggression from the PRC. We need to recognize the strategic realities of the 21st century, and that is Taiwan is an independent state. It's a key ally of the United States. It should be. And it needs to be defended against the PRC's prodigious capabilities in theater, both in conventional sense, tactical nuclear sense, at the theater level, and they're, alarmingly, their growing strategic arsenal, which is worrying. And this commitment that has been made is a very welcome development to augment deterrence, because we do not want aggression to occur.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we've argued at the Committee on the Present Danger China, deterring is infinitely to be preferred over actually fighting if deterrence fails. Let me just press you on this one question, Brad, because I think I may have a different view. The idea of putting American personnel on Kinmen, which is, our colleague John Mills pointed out, some 4,000 feet off the Chinese coast, may not be as effective in terms of deterring as, say, having them on Taiwan proper. But actually, just a formula for kind of losing those guys very early in a fight. What are your thoughts on that? Is it critical, do you think, to deterrence that we deploy right to that forward position?
Well, there are risks, Frank, that you've addressed. I think that those risks need to be considered carefully. But it is. The point of having a force there is to augment their deterrent Taiwanese military deterrent capabilities, as well as to serve as a tripwire, which is absolutely essential and not dissimilar to what we did during the Cold War with West Berlin, ultimately the Berlin Brigade, but a commitment that the United States made to West Berlin that there would not be one inch and we would not give in to salami tactics. The PRC, as you well know, are expert at starting to not only violate on a regular basis the maritime as well as essentially the sovereignty in the environment of the air as well as at sea, cutting cables, communications cables, data cables with these islands, all as precursors to aggression. As you've stressed, Frank, many times, to normalize essentially these violations of Taiwan's sovereignty in preparation for invasion. So having tripwires with the risks that are entailed, and those risks are considerable, and they're augmented by the fact that we do not have a force posture yet in the area. Conventional or tactical nuclear weapons presence on Taiwan or in theater, which we should have. So, for example, in Berlin, we did not run those risks because we had considerable conventional power. And at one time, we had a nuclear monopoly that was then later backed by considerable numbers of tactical as well as theater and strategic forces. So that risk is a considerable one. It needs to be weighed. Yet I still support it because it's necessary to ensure not one step back, and that indeed deterrence carries considerable risks against a foe who's hyper-aggressive and who's got great capabilities. But now is the time to recognize the realities of the 21st century.
I appreciate your clarity on that point, Brad. Let me ask you about some other aspects of this, Brad, and this is maybe coming at you from an oblique angle. But one of the other things that John Mills has pointed out is that something between 30 and 50% of the Army's capacity to put in place temporary or mobile piers, which might come in very handy in support of island defenses or island taking operations, should it go kinetic out in the Pacific, is now tied up in Gaza. And unbelievably, and I know this is out of your area, but unbelievably, there was a report this week that the USAID, the Agency for International Development, has just contracted with Qatar and a Hamas-owned company to actually run that pier. I mean, John says, we're not going to get that pier back to go deploy into the Pacific. This seems to me to be another countervailing signal to the Chinese that whatever we're doing with special operations in small numbers, and by the way, cutting their funding in this present, the new 2025 budget, we're signaling that we are further dissipating our capabilities elsewhere out of theater. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, indeed we are, and we no longer have, if we ever had the luxury, we certainly don't have it in this situation. The fact that this leaked, I think, is telling, Frank. As you well know with your time in the Pentagon, there's, you know, the timing, of course, is so substantial. There must be alarming indicators that China is moving quickly, and the Biden administration wants to make some effort, however imperfect, at this stage to augment deterrence, because things are moving very quickly, as we've stressed time and again. Things in Taiwan could happen at any time. It could happen today. It could happen tomorrow.
And this is one of the things that we so appreciate about your you know, work in so many respects. Your new book, Embracing Communist China, as well as your joint essays with Captain Fennell. We'll talk a bit more about all of that on the other side of a short break. Stay tuned. The
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, a cargo ship destroyed a key piece of infrastructure, crippling transportation in Baltimore, one of America's most important ports. At this point, we don't know why the vessel crashed into a vital bridge transiting the city's harbor. What we do know is that this is not the only example of events that have ravaged the country in the recent past. Others include a series of train derailments and loss of dozens of food production facilities, not one but two improbably struck by aircraft. These were reportedly all accidents, yet we're on notice that our critical infrastructure is highly vulnerable to sabotage. And thanks especially to Benedict Biden's open borders, tens of thousands of fighting-age men here from jihadist nations and communist China may have that as a mission. We must adopt a war footing to mitigate such threats now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Dr. Bradley Thayer, a friend and colleague with us at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, one of our really leading experts on the whole problem of the Chinese Communist Party. And as he was saying in the previous block, the possibility that it could at any moment begin a kinetic war against Taiwan, and I fear against us as well. A factor in all of that, unquestionably, has to be, what do the Chinese make of Joe Biden? And do they, in their deterrence calculations, discount the prospect that the United States would do much in the event they do decide to go kinetic, as they say? Brad, we had this week a somewhat underwhelming presentation, I have to say, by the House Republicans about evidence that they have accumulated of the, well, penetration, shall we say, of the Biden crime family by the Chinese Communist Party, certainly its compromise by the CCP. What did you make of the evidence presented, and what do you think the Chinese are making of Joe Biden? In light of it,
the evidence is damning, of course, and now it's so much as surfacing. What was long suspected or known, if you will, obliquely, is now surfacing. And so what do the Chinese think of the fact that he's betrayed the country is at a minimum impeachable, and he's deserving, if those charges are made, of conviction in the Senate, of course, which will not happen. And it's not clear, of course, Frank, as you well know, that we could, that an impeachment, sad to say, could even pass the House, given the balance of power there. What do the Chinese make of it? They think they're lucky stars every day they have Joe Biden as president. I mean, they can't believe their luck. Yeah. They're good fortune, but, well, they have this individual.
They worked for that. It's not just a question of luck, of course. They they paid handsomely for it, I guess one might say.
Well, they paid trivially for it. I mean, it was pennies.
That's true. I mean, handsomely for the Biden team, that's for sure, but pennies on the dollar for their purposes. And again, I guess the question is, if we're really facing the possibility that we might find not just our friends and our forces now in Taiwan embroiled in a military conflict brought on by the Chinese Communist Party. But as you know, right there, we may find ourselves facing conflict here at home, instigated by the CCP and perhaps prosecuted, you know, with devastating effect by the tens of thousands of People's Liberation Army personnel we think have been insinuated into the country over Joe Biden's open border. Is this net not pretty much an attractive opportunity for the CCP to act belligerently against us as well?
It is. Frank, we were speaking in the earlier block about deterrence and U.S. Purported commitment or U.S. forces on Kunming. It's also the case that Xi Jinping is thinking about that as well in terms of how to threaten us with unacceptable punishment and having these men come in, obviously PLA, obviously MSS, obviously police.
MSS is the intelligence service.
Yes. And this is muscle that could be used to attack our infrastructure, to assassinate individuals, to seize facilities, to conduct election interference on November 5th. The list of covert action, of course, is and the opportunities presented are quite long. So this is an aspect of a very important signal as well, that this muscle is now in the United States in conjunction to the biological weapons facility that was discovered in California. Who knows how many more of those exist? The land that they've purchased. We know, of course, about how they're laundering money through marijuana sales and growing in Maine and in other states.
And over 300,000 students here, and God only knows how many other businessmen and so on. Now, I think this all adds up to, you know, an attractive nuisance, I think, into the legal definition. You know, a swimming pool that doesn't have a fence is irresistible attraction. But Brad, let me ask you about one other aspect of this quickly, because it's very much top of my mind, as I think you know. We've been talking with this audience a lot about it. And unfortunately, as we speak, the House of Representatives is poised to, I think, probably clear the way effectively for one of the other lines of attack of the Chinese Communist Party in their unrestricted warfare against us, namely the use of so-called international organizations like specifically the World Health Organization to engineer a kind of global governance, obviously at the expense of our sovereignty and I think medical freedoms and states' rights and so on. But talk to me about this play and what might result from it in terms of advancing this agenda, which you describe brilliantly in your book, Embracing the Chinese Communist Party or Communist China. Very much the detriment, if not the ultimate demise of our nation.
Well, it's a profound failure. And the attack that the CCP is executing against us is all azimuths. It includes that muscle on the ground coming over an open border. It includes growth of military capabilities, diplomatic measures, but it also includes penetrating and hollowing out and then turning against us international institutions like the World Health Organization. So while at the same time, they create new institutions that they will dominate, which does not have, if you will, the dead hand of the Anglo-American creation of the international order in the wake of World War II and the Cold War. So what we're seeing is that weaponization and attack, as you identified, with a new vector, Frank, and that is to erode American identity, American conceptions of sovereignty, to undermine us with TikTok, to undermine us with fentanyl, to undermine us essentially, again, all azimuths. The attack is ubiquitous, it's sustained, it's ongoing, and it needs leadership to address this, U.S. presidential leadership address this and to terminate it. It's past that time, while also putting them on the back foot, because they are weak, they're illegitimate, and they need to be overthrown and can be working. Obviously, the Chinese people will do this in conjunction with their diaspora and in conjunction with people of goodwill around the world. But it's time to put them on
provided the back foot. There is some leadership emanating from our country in support of all of that, and that is absent at the moment. And again, Brad, our book, The Indictment, which you helped inform greatly, and yours with Jim Fennell, Embracing Communist China, it makes a very important point about not only don't we have that kind of presidential leadership, we have a captured elite in this country, yes, in the political space, but also in so many others, that is making vastly more problematic the kinds of, you know, defenses you're talking about, or even offensive efforts with the Chinese Communist Party to overthrow this menace to them and obviously threat to us as well.
Well, indeed, they're assisting that, obviously, through the engagement school that we talk about in the book, this which has us in a headlock, the idea that we must engage with them, which is, again, returned to the fore with the Biden administration after it was arrested under Trump, after the policies began to change under President Trump. The consequences of that are, of course, that we're just continuing to save the CCP. We're continuing to strengthen them so that they can hurt us, if you will, more effectively and with greater avenues of attack.
It can only embolden them further to act aggressively using all of those capabilities. It must be stopped. Brett Thayer, thank you for your contribution to stopping it. Thank you for joining us to talk a bit about, among other things, embracing communist China. I encourage everyone to check it out.
Thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure.
Soon. Thank you, my friend. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say we're joined by David Wormser, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he runs our Mideast program. He brings to that task a wealth of experience, notably as a man who rose through the ranks of the United States Naval Intelligence Corps to that of Lieutenant Commander. He has also been an assistant and guru to an undersecretary of state, a national security advisor, and a vice president in the course of his distinguished career in government. David Wormser, welcome back, sir. It's always a delight to have you with us.
It's always an honor, Frank. It's always an honor to be with you.
Good. Well, thank you. I did want to start with a topic that we've touched on before, but I think has become even more outrageous in light of recent developments, and that is this port that the president has decided to build in Gaza using what turned out to be very limited resources of the United States Army to create these sorts of temporary ports, especially at a moment when we may well need every bit of that capability and frankly a lot more at some place or point in the Pacific. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, the whole port issue is a real mystifying one that is so mystifying that I think you need to look for the backstories there. And there's a couple of them. I mean, the first is just came out by Baruch Yadid, a correspondent for Channel 14, uncovered that the United States is insisting that a Qatari company be awarded the contract for managing this port. That Qatari company is a subsidiary of Hamas. It's owned by Hamas. So essentially, the United States now is asking or trying to slide under the table to the Israelis a port that will be run by Hamas right under Israel's nose in northern. So you can imagine right off the bat the security issues that obtain, which then puts us in a position, the United States in a position where we could become in a conflict with Israel over the movements of this port, which are servicing Hamas's interests that we protect.
Even before you get there, the whole idea that Israel is determined to destroy Hamas and the United States government is now talking about making a precious asset, no less, but one that is fraught in so many respects. I mean, what will be coming in on that port, and will American personnel be, you know, obliged to be there to protect it or operate it? And the possibility, not least, that, you know, people will be removed through that port to come here in large numbers. I mean, all of these things are, for example,
we do know that there have been some staffers in the NSC and in the government and the Biden administration who have requested some examination from the immigration authorities here. What would be required to ease up on the entry of Palestinians into the United States? So I could imagine this port becomes a free entry point for God knows who. I don't know if they want to have a million Palestinians, but I think they may think that they can bring in and protect from Israel the free movement of certain Hamas types that Israel otherwise would arrest.
Yeah. Well, especially if perhaps more than that. Being managed by the by Hamas. Again, David, just level set with me here. Am I missing something? What does it automatically do if our purpose in this exercise is 100% at odds with Israel's strategic objective?
We have changed in the last month to 2 months from acquiescence in Israel's war against Hamas to opposition. I think U.S. policy now is very clearly to save Hamas. We saw it a month and a half ago when they started talking about this technocratic reformed Palestinian Authority that could include parts of Hamas. And then we started seeing it with the absolute opposition to Israel's taking the remainder of Gaza and erasing the Hamas government. Then we saw it a few days ago with a U.S. statement by Sullivan in a press conference where he said the objective of the U.S. is to degrade Hamas, not to destroy, degrade. And I think this speaks to the fact that we're trying to come to a regional deal with Iran, and Iran's demand is that Hamas survives. Because for Iran, that would be a strategic defeat. So they've enlisted the temptation.
If Hamas were, in fact, eradicated, would be a strategic defeat.
If Hamas were eradicated. So I think they've essentially tempted this administration into a regional deal with Iran that saves Hamas, in exchange for which the United States doesn't see further escalation against our troops in Iraq and Syria and Hezbollah and so forth. So I think basically the United States has strategically chosen to side with Iran to restrain Israel.
Adjustments in behavior did not include the Houthis, who seem to be increasingly both intent on and capable of taking down one or more of our vessels in the region. No?
Well, the Iranians are playing us. They're trying, they keep trying to put, they saw our intelligence estimate where we said we're not sure that Iran fully controls all its proxies. So the Iranians are experts at manipulation. They're the ones who invented the story of 1001 Nights and chess, and they know how to manipulate. So they're running with that. And they say, you know, well, we can't really control the Houthis, but you know, if you give us enough strategically, maybe we'll have the stature that we could convince the Houthis to behave a little more. But I see the resolution of that one to be the same as what's happening in Gaza. Essentially, I see a ceasefire eventually happening, where the United States manages to convince the Houthis to shut down the attacks. Other than ships heading toward Israel. So in other words, there will be a blockade of Israel at the end of this.
Yeah, from the Houthis. Well, that seems entirely possible. David, let me turn to a feature of all of this that is being used in part to justify this port, and that is the idea that Israel is now collectively punishing the people of Gaza by starving them to death. This is being now touted by the UN and various specialists that it has consulted. When you were last on the program, I believe we talked about there being twice as much food going into Hamas, into Gaza, as had been the case prior to the conflict. You mentioned that there is a distribution problem with that food, but what do you say to this argument that if Israel doesn't have a ceasefire and allow food to be poured in by every means imaginable, sea, land, air, that it will be guilty of this genocide against the innocent people of Gaza?
There are no restrictions on food and humanitarian supplies being leveled by Israel. They will allow anything through that goes through. They're not restricting it at all. And as a result, it's still twice as much. In some cases, I think this week it's been averaging over 200 trucks a day of food, whereas before the war it was 70. So we're talking about much more now than twice the amount of food. We're about 4 to 5 pounds of food per day per human being, to baby, infant, elderly in Gaza. If you look at any country in the world, 5 pounds of food a day is a lot. So there's no food shortage. It's a distribution shortage, but the distribution shortage is a strategic manipulation of the distribution of food by Hamas. So the distribution issue has become a strategic weapon against Israel employed by Hamas. And the more Britain, the United States, and others fall into this, the more, once again, the United States is taking the strategic side of Hamas against Israel. The solution to this is to get rid of Hamas, and then you start rebuilding, and everybody gets their food, and people who are killing Jews and beheading them don't, or they get food but in jail. That's the solution, and the faster we get there, the faster any humanitarian issues go away. But we are now cooperating with Hamas in a massive propaganda effort that is a strategic attack on Israel.
And may well result in, at the end, Israel's position becoming untenable in not just Gaza, but in the region more generally. This is unconscionable. As this is happening, David, there's talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, a man that the Biden administration insists is single-handedly responsible for all of this and must go. Democratically, if possible. It seems other ways might be contemplated as well. Bibi may be coming to the United States to have face-to-face conversations with some, maybe on the Hill, maybe elsewhere. There's talk about him doing a joint session of Congress speech. He's done that in the past, notably with the Iran deal. Is it advisable, do you think, for him to do that?
Well, last time he did it was 2015. He came. It was an orderly process. He gave a speech. He could make his case directly to the American people and to the legislative branch. And that's what angered President Obama so much, was that on American turf, Netanyahu's position, once fully exposed, made more sense and was more in line with American values than were the positions taken by Obama. And that's what so undermined him. What we've seen in the United States, though, is no longer a stilted debate or a unhappy debate. We've seen the destruction of public debate in America and the silencing of those who one disagrees with. And in the case here, I'm worried that there would be a boycott and disruption of the actual speech. I think that the Prime Minister might want to look at another venue that has symbolic importance.
I couldn't agree more. David Wormser, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, as always, for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. We look forward to a new paper coming out on this port in the near future, and thank you for your leadership in all these matters. God bless you. Come back to us again soon with updates. We'll be right back with more, folks. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, a cargo ship destroyed a key piece of infrastructure, crippling transportation in Baltimore, one of America's most important ports. At this point, we don't know why the vessel crashed into a vital bridge transiting the city's harbor. What we do know is that this is not the only example of events that have ravaged the country in the recent past. Others include a series of train derailments and loss of dozens of food production facilities, not one, but two, and probably struck by aircraft. These were reportedly all accidents, yet we're on notice that our critical infrastructure is highly vulnerable to sabotage. And thanks especially to Benedict Biden's open borders, tens of thousands of fighting-age men here from jihadist nations and communist China may have that as a mission. We must adopt a war footing to mitigate such threats now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is the Honorable Robert Charles, and I use that term literally as well as in an honorific sense. He served in a number of capacities in the United States government, including most recently as an Assistant Secretary of State. He has, however, worked in the other two branches of government as well, as a senior investigator on Capitol Hill and as a clerk in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a man of considerable expertise and insight, and we're always delighted to catch up with him. Bobby, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Always glad to be on this show.
Thank you. Let me begin by asking you about a very important piece that you wrote, which really connected the dots in an important way between the nightmare that is now unfolding again in Haiti and the Biden administration's energy policies. We know that they're having a very damaging effect on our own energy security, but how have they contributed to what is now happening that is making this chronically failed state fail yet again?
You know, Frank, it is difficult in the modern era to have an original thought, but the thought occurred to me having my bureau in 2004 deployed to Haiti to try to stabilize it, air wing, et cetera, and did stabilize it. And as you say, in 1994, 2004, they were unstable. But the thought occurred to me that the energy crisis that they're facing, which prompted a lot of these protests in 2021, and ultimately the assassination of their president, and ultimately beyond that, even protests and riots and the breakdown of rule of law in 2022 were very much related to fuel, the cost of fuel. So I went back and looked at the data for the export to Haiti and where they get it, how much it cost. And what I found was remarkable. What I found is that almost all of their 500 million barrels of oil a year come from the United States. That in itself is not remarkable. But what was remarkable is that the price jumped from the end of 2020, when President Trump was exporting there. It jumped from $39 a barrel to 70 by mid 2021 and 94 by early 2022. So what happened here, Frank, is that the Biden administration, I think probably unwittingly, but as so much of what they do is either negligent or reckless or in some cases intentional, but here I think it was just reckless or negligent, they clamped down. They basically have tried to have imperiled the fossil fuel industry in the United States. They took away energy independence. And in that process, they drove the price of gas and oil in this country up to, you had a 9% inflation rate in August of 2022. They created really an enormous problem in this country, of course, added inflation from overspending. And what they did to Haiti is they essentially put a noose around their neck and pulled it tight. They put Haiti in a position where they are unable, were unable to function at that price point for oil and gas. So if you ask, why is Haiti a disaster now and 1,000 Americans can't get out and the State Department isn't apparently deploying their air wing this time to get them out or helping, you know, get them out. They're just telling them, get to the airport and leave. We told you you should have. If you ask why this happened, ironically, this happened, Frank, because a huge contributor to the demise of Haiti at the moment is the Biden energy policies.
Wow.
Robert, you know, it is increasingly clear that both the policies themselves, but also the manifestation they are of the larger agenda of climate change mitigation is having knock-on effects all over the world. Farmers not being able to produce the food that people need, nations, you know, failing to meet energy and food requirements for their publics and therefore, you know, careening into real extremis. This one happens to have some profound effects for us here in the United States, yes, though, as well, as it is contributing, as you know, to part of that migration flow, that crisis across the border or now at sea. And Bobby, I mean, you have to be, tremendously empathetic with the people of Haiti, who are among the most long-suffering in the world, I think it's fair, yes, to say. I didn't know that the State Department had an air wing, honestly, so that's a little bit of a surprise, but this would
actually,
be
principally... People don't know that the State Department, at the time I was there, had about 400 airframes. We use them for transport, we have armed Black Hawks, we have all kinds of things, Frank. Hmm.
So this would be principally, though, as you say,
no.
Americans out of places like Haiti.
Yeah, so it has primarily been used in Colombia, Bolivia, Peru, Pakistan, places where you needed to do counter-narcotics work or you needed to extract people. It is not the primary mission of the INL Air Wing to extract people, but they have the capacity. They have C-130s. And unfortunately, another untold story here is that although it is probably the most capable air wing outside of the Pentagon and robust, and we operated at an 85% OR rate, which is an extraordinarily high op tempo, and we helped it deployed and helped everybody, help people in Iraq, in Afghanistan. One of the things people don't realize is that air wing is slowly disintegrating over time, and I think now they have perhaps 150 airframes, rotor wing and fixed wing. I ran that air wing with the Bureau, and the reality is we put most of what we did down there was people on the ground to support the UN mission. But when and if you need airframes, the State Department is supposed to be able to assist in that. And I do question, after Afghanistan in particular, Frank, I question whether this State Department is really taking care of the air wing and taking care of, frankly, a lot of other missions that are important in countries where stabilization is the number one priority.
Yeah, well, and I guess it goes without saying, but taking care of the people that are being left behind in circumstances like Afghanistan, notably, but also now in Haiti. Bobby, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to switch gears to talk a bit about something else you've recently commented on, which is the state of the inquiry into the investigation, the so-called January 6th investigation. You're writing at the Association for Mature American Citizens, AMAC.us, is superb, and we'll talk a little bit about some of your very interesting insights into what we're learning about what actually went down on January 6th committee right after this. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, former counsel to the George H.W. Bush and Reagan White Houses for congressional liaison, the author of, among other things, Eagles and Evergreens, and one of our go-to resources. We're very proud to have him as one of our regulars here. Bobby, thank you for the job that you do as the spokesman for a terrific organization of which I'm proud to be a member, AMAC. Thank you for joining us each week. Let me just turn, if I may, to something that you've written about at AMAC.us concerning revelations by Barry Loudermilk, congressman from Georgia, who is heading up the inquiry into the whole January 6th event on Capitol Hill, and especially, I think, the inquiry that was done by the so-called January 6th committee, at Nancy Pelosi's behest. There was a very important report that I think didn't get a whole lot of attention, other than by you, that Congressman Loudermilk issued recently. Talk a bit about its findings. Sure. And the takeaway.
You know, Frank, Congressman Loudermilk in many ways is one of these unsung heroes in the Congress who is high integrity and is there for what I would like to think, and I think are truly the right reasons. We hear a lot from Jim Jordan. We hear a lot from Mr. Comer, but we have not heard that much from Congressman Loudermilk, who has been doing the full investigation into the January 6th committee's work. And honestly,
I want to say we have had him on this program to talk a little bit about it, but we need to get him back in connection with this report. Go ahead.
Well, this report is stunning because what it does is it essentially takes the buttresses out from underneath the narrative that was presented about what occurred on January 6th. So it says, for example, and it's very clear, it's taken this long because the Democrats hid the encryption keys to 100 of the files, would not turn them over, took the depositions and the interviews, and 2 days before the gavel was handed to the Republicans, handed off many of those to the White House for safekeeping. Well, that's not the way separation of powers works. It's not about the party that controls one thing controls all things. It's about the fact that the United States Congress has chain of custody over every deposition. I did dozens of depositions and interviews during my time as a litigator and ultimately also on the Hill as an investigator. And you don't just hide them and give them away to people. Well, they couldn't get them back without redactions, and they are even in that fight right now. In fact, as I understand it, DHS has not honored all of their subpoenas, et cetera, et cetera. But what they have found is exculpatory evidence, and this is really important. In a court of law, there there's evidence called Brady material or Jenks material, which must be produced by a prosecutor if it shows the innocence or indicates the potential innocence of the party accused. Well, it turns out we have hundreds of parties that were accused, some of them being indicted for just walking on the grounds. We also have a very selective, interestingly, a selective prosecution of reporters. There is at least one conservative reporter who has just been just shredded and put through the ringer. Meantime, these tapes indicate that you had reporters for the New York Times and others climbing through these same windows, walking peacefully among these same peacefully walking people. So a very selective prosecution, I'll note. But you also have things like the Democrats propagated the idea that Republicans had surveilled ahead of time for this. Well, the hundreds of hours of videos show very clearly they lied outright. They knew that this was not true, and they still did it. Perhaps the biggest lie is that they say Donald Trump did not deploy the National Guard. It turns out they discovered that days ahead of time, he gave full authorization to Nancy Pelosi and to Mayor Bowser to deploy the National Guard to protect the Capitol. So the entire narrative breaks down,
and
Frank.
It was spurned by Pelosi.
It was spurned by both of them. So, you know, the whole narrative breaks down, and it becomes, you know, one of the most, I think, disheartening things for me to see is that Liz Cheney, who was vice chair of this group, apparently sat in on every single interview and deposition and literally browbeat these people. By my opinion, as I hear what I read, is that she was trying to coerce them to change testimony. And, you know, as an attorney, she shouldn't have done that. As someone who surely knows that there's a right and a wrong, and that the purpose of interviews and depositions is to elicit truth, not to reshape facts so that you can get something on record. And now you've got witnesses changing their testimony. What happens in the the end here, Frank, is you look at the totality of this information, and as an average citizen, you say, look, there was a lot of bad behavior up there, for sure, and several hundred out of 120,000 people did things they should not have done, and others followed behind them. But the reality on all of this is that this was not what it's described as. This was never an insurrection. And what they did is they created a storyline, a storyboard, and they put it out to the American people, and they hid the exculpatory evidence that would have shown that's not really what this was about.
Right. Hid it, including from defendants.
Who yes, have been apparently.
Ruthlessly prosecuted and punished. And Bobby, let me just ask you this, because I think it goes to the heart of my concern about all of this, is does the Loudermilk report address the evidence that there were provocateurs apparently working with the FBI in the crowd, and that some of that bad behavior, and I'm not going to excuse everybody, but at least some of the bad behavior seems to have been perpetrated by those agents?
I did not read that, Frank, but it's about 125-page report. It has a lot of detail in it, and Loudermilk is notorious, or I guess I should say famous, for being thoughtful and careful and non. He's going to ask you to reach your own conclusions when you read the data. He's not going to reach the conclusions for you in many cases. So I just credit him. Yeah.
The other piece that I just wonder whether it was a matter of focus, and we'll see if we can get him to come back on and answer these questions himself. But Bobby, one of the other things that's just always jumped out at me was not only did Nancy Pelosi not take President Trump up on his offer to have the National Guard deployed, you know, preemptively, if you will, mm-hmm. but she actually lowered the readiness, the security readiness of the buildings on Capitol Hill to below normal business. Not only did she not elevate them, but she lowered it, all of which just smacks, to my way of thinking, of very likely an operation, to put it bluntly.
You know, to be honest, Frank, I don't have the data to reach that conclusion.
I know, but... and we don't have the time to discuss it either. I just wanted to lay that out there as a matter of concern. Yeah. We look forward to further visiting with you about this and so much more. Bobby Charles, thank you for your time today and your great service, ongoing service to our country at amac.us. God bless. Come back to us as well, my friends, next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.